We're getting them up to your God. Sorry.
Great. Thank you. So, let's reconvene the commission. I'd like to go back to the outcome measurements and some of the emails that we received. The next email that I was going to reference was that was provided by Ms. Reed. And you had identified some areas in your email. Are there any areas you wanted to add, or any areas you listed there that you wanted to expand on? I did note one that I wanted to comment about, which I thought was intriguing, and that is regarding the physician's attendance at hearings. We have a structure in the DUI context where lab testers can testify by affidavit unless the defendant objects. I think it would, unless the judges have a heartburn with this, it seems to me that if a physician has completed the affidavit, it's not a contested hearing. Why make or even try to have the physician or other expert appearing in court? That doesn't make sense and seems to be an unnecessary cost. And I'm thinking that that's an area that could be addressed by rule. We wouldn't even have to wait for statute. Judge Sturman, Judge Ochoa, Judge Jordan, what do you think about that?
This is Judge Sturman. Are you talking about a contested hearing, or are you talking about the first, just hearing on a petition to appoint?
Hearing a petition to appoint.
Oh, absolutely, I agree. It seems also that it would be helpful if we had sort of like a short trial kind of approach for contested hearings, because that's a big expense to get a doctor to come in and testify. It's $5,000.
Right. You're right. You're absolutely right. Even in contested cases, unless there's a real concern about the expert's testimony, if the parties can stipulate to that admission or there is a real need for some authentication of some kind, it seems like you could still go forward on that basis. So,
Where the protected person's attorney does the job.
Sure, of course, yeah. Judge Ochoa, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, that's a matter that when I set the day's trial, I asked the parties to go ahead and accept the forms without the judge being present, and they usually agree by stipulation. On the form itself, I would like to know what materials the doctor relied on, whether they're the actual treating doctor or just a person that saw the patient for the first time, and also what records they relied on. But that's not in the form right now.
Very good point. Okay. Ms. Reed, I asked you a question and I interrupted you. Were there any things you wanted to add regarding outcome measurements?
Thank you, yes, Dean Reed. Just a couple things, and again, on the physician attendance at hearing, I appreciate the openness to the use of affidavits or something short of physician attendance. I think part of the challenge, as Judge pointed out, is the lack of information that comes in on the form. Oftentimes, it's very vague, needs assistance. There's no real explanation of behaviors that would necessitate certain types of requests, and oftentimes what I find when I'm actually able to have access to medical information prior to the time that my client is appointed is often what is on the form conflicts with what is in the medical records. And so I think that there is a real danger in having a form that is sort of light on information and then getting a bank of medical records where the information and the diagnoses are not consistent with what's on the form. So I would like to be able to see how we can sort of streamline this so the appropriate information is brought before the court, yet we're not pulling physicians away from their daily duties needlessly simply because of a hearsay objection, even though there's no real contest to the guardianship. So I appreciate the willingness to look at other alternatives for getting this information before the court. Most of my points are literally tied to some sort of statutory requirement. And I admit they are all based on more than one occasion of or instance of occurrence, such as protected people not being at hearings when a request for a guardianship is made, and there's really and oftentimes they haven't been represented by counsel, and so that person is not part of the dialogue. And the question of how often does a guardianship go forward and a petition is awarded without this individual actually being present and having a voice in court. Sometimes, again, what you find is when an individual is present in court, their behaviors and the personality that they exhibit is very different from what's on the paper. And so I'm just curious as to the numbers of guardianships that essentially are awarded when an individual has not come to court prior to that. And again, some things are simple, such as the predicate of filing an identification. Prior to imposing a guardianship, there have been instances where, again, as a third-party recipient of petitions, can't access, based on HIPAA claims, somebody's ID until my client, the public guardian, is appointed. And then as it turns out, the person who was actually in court is not the person whose ID was filed, or there's no ID filed. So it's creating real problems, I think, in the provision of services in some respects. So I'm just curious as to what the statistics are, and they're all statutory requirements. And the last one's just interesting to me regarding how investigations are being utilized, and once the state compliance office is up and running with investigators, what the statistics are between the local sort of body of investigators and then the state office, and how those numbers play out. I think that would be good information to have also in terms of accountability.
Mallory, Sabrina, Riley, do you capture some of the information that Danny has mentioned here?
Yes, we do. Oh, Mallory Nelson, for the record. We do, and again, through the milestone tracker, I can't help but plug that feature every time I get a chance. The milestone tracker, we now require that the forms of ID be separately filed with a cover sheet. They're filed under seal so that we can register that they have been received. And while the statute, I believe, allows it for 120 days after filing, according to our milestones, we require that at the time of filing to address the very issue which Damien has brought up.
Riley?
Well, I know we have the court cover sheets that we haven't lifted the information from those particular cover sheets and put them into a report, but again, if it's something we need to track, we'll either make it happen or have a good excuse why it can, a good reason, but we can... We can look at that as well.
Great. I think the point of this is that to the extent these things are being called out in the statute, it's something we clearly should be trying to address. If we can, Sabrina, do you want to add something?
Yes, Sabrina Sweet, for the record. I was speaking with Mallory briefly at the break, and my suggestion, and this may be a large undertaking for the three of us to do this, but within the next 30 days, you've already tasked us with going through the list to determine which outcome measures we can track. But my thought was to go through each of the suggestions from all the commission members and document all of those and expand that grid that we provided today to include all of the outcome measures that we currently are tracking, as well as the ones that are suggested by the commission, and determine whether or not we're currently tracking those and what our capabilities are in each district. And then I've also spoken with Robin, and I can reach out to Carson City and Elko and some of the rural communities as well and provide that information back to the commission.
Well, in the interest of time, that might be the most effective way to proceed. I guess the only question I would have then is, for those of you who submitted an email or those of you who did not, is there anything that you would like to add to your submission or offer as a new submission? Deborah, you submitted an email. Elizabeth, you did as well.
I do have something I'd like to add. Can someone pass the mic?
We can hear you.
Yes.
Yeah, I would like to track the number, in addition to that, the number of foreign guardians.
Foreign guardians, because that's
those
new.
Those who reside out of state, right. And I think if it were possible to triage the dollar value of these states, that could be helpful. And finally, I think if we could simply count the number of contested matters, because I would bet that 95% of the matters are taking up 20% of the time and vice versa. Thank you.
Okay. Deborah, do you want to add anything to your submission?
Not in terms of the information that was provided for the 8th and the 2nd, I thought was an excellent start at what was being tracked. Coming from the rurals, the only thing that I would say is, you know, I work with so many different courts, and everyone does it a little bit differently. And especially as we move forward, being able to make sure that, you know, all of the outcomes are the same and being tracked similarly, all of the coding issues in terms of kind of like filing those particular rules would be really, I think, helpful and streamline the process for attorneys out in the rurals.
Jennifer, Sam, you submitted an email. Is there anything you wanted to add to your list of issues there? It looked like several weren't necessarily outcome measurements, but suggestions for other areas to be looked at.
I don't think that I maybe didn't focus as much as on statistical measurements as much as general outcomes, but I don't think I have anything to add to the as far as.
Homa, anything else you want to add?
Homa Wedram, for the record. I think all I was trying to do is acknowledge that I really liked what was generated from the 2nd and the 8th. I just wanted to see if there was bandwidth for us to distinguish between what an adjudicated case is, or you know what I mean, what that outcome was. But you had very carefully put it, and I appreciated the clarification that, well, let's baby step it, look at what we're able to provide right now, make sure that's what we're rolling out statewide, and then tinker with it as we go. So I didn't mean to go so specific. I was, you know, meaning that I liked what's already being gathered. Obviously, what Mr. Birchtold was talking about with council representation, that would be huge to get real numbers on those sorts of things. Presence of the protected person at the hearing or proposed protected person, just all those safeguards that are in the statute. And we want to, you know, and it's not necessarily within the judiciary's control, except that, you know, does it or does it not happen? And is that a deal breaker for the case moving forward? Because I know Mallory Nelson and I had been emailing back and forth about this question of admonishments. And I think that would be a question, too, that ties into the presence of the person at the hearing. In Clark County, I don't know what the practice is right now, but, you know, during my years of practice in Clark County, people were just using admonishments of rights as a form to show, oh, well, we told the person about the hearing and they didn't want to come. That's kind of a dangerous land to be in when there's no statutory justification for that even existing, and I couldn't find it in the rules either. So when I asked Mallory, well, let me see your form in the second, she said, what form? We don't do that. The judge admonishes the person in court. And I said, oh, that's a problem.
I must say, I haven't seen a chart like this.
Crazy. You said you liked charts. If you recall, you did say you liked
it
charts.
It reminded me an awful lot of when I studied for the bar exam.
I was trying to kiss up. That's okay.
But we will hang on to it because I can see that it'll have some future use. But I do appreciate the effort that was rather imaginative. Okay. Do any other commission members or committee members have anything they want to add with respect to the task we've asked Riley and Sabrina and Mallory to undertake? Yes, Jennifer.
Perhaps we should track actions filed or causes filed under the Patient Bill of Rights. It would be beneficial to know how many are being filed and possibly outcomes. All that same type of data.
Sure.
And then when people are guardian, should easily be tracked by this coding that order as a removal of guardian order, so that is a trackable.
Trackable, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, did you guys get the first point about the Bill of Rights? And these are, of course, causes of action that are initiated under that statute. I don't know, Riley, in the 8th, do you all break down statutory lawsuits like that? Because this isn't something that would necessarily be, could be filed in the guardianship proceeding, but it more likely is going to be filed just with the general juror judge.
I don't think we do. There are petitions that request permission to file a certain lawsuit or not, but I don't know that anybody has filed an action on the Bill of Rights yet, so there's
well,
no
Well, technically it doesn't go into effect until January 1st, so.
Right,
well, there's your answer for that.
So what I was.
I do think we had, if we had a code on our cover sheet.
I think that it would be, well, unless you folks decide to assign those differently, Judge Sturman, is it maybe the chief judge of the district hasn't decided this yet, but would those cases be assigned to a general jurisdiction judge, or would they come back to you folks?
This is Judge Sturman. We will certainly ask our chief for guidance.
Okay, and then based on that, Riley can have some direction about what to do. I don't know what the second point is. Are those cases going to come back to you, Judge Doherty? Are they going to file as general juror?
And I admit to thinking more of them would be filed in the guardianship case than not. But your point is well taken.
The statute is it's a general civil cause of action.
And my concern also, representing the public guardian that we might face a 1983 case in federal court for overreach. So I've thought about that a lot. I'm not convinced, based on the types of suits that are filed against government entities, that it would be something simple in the guardianship action. So hopefully this will not happen, but should I ever see one come my way, I'll make sure that I inform.
Well, to Mr. Michelson's point, if we could report to the legislature after tracking this that zero were filed, that would be some measurement of success, I would hope, at least progress. Right, John?
Yeah, I think that hotline is a good idea. It's like where I live, people complain about the airport noise, and we have a phone number we dial. So if we prominently display, if you have complaints about guardianship, I don't know how prominent we want it to be, but we get the number out there. That's one way to measure is just how many complaints we get each year. Is that going down? Maybe we could even quantify what kinds of complaints we're getting.
So one of the things I was discussing with Robin Sweet is on the subject of the hotline is our plan is to assign each commission member a responsibility every other day. You have the responsibility. That sound like a good plan?
John wants to volunteer.
Judge, I chose my cell phone out there, I think.
No, we aren't going to do that. Okay, so I think Riley, Sabrina, and Mallory, we've picked on you guys long enough. I think we've got some general direction here, and we can have a document in front of us that allows then the commission at its next meeting to vote up some of these things. What I would like to suggest, though, in doing this, is that we look more globally at outcome measurements, kind of along the lines that Ms. Kelly had identified, where we're saying the statute expects, and we expect, 100% appointment of lawyers in all cases. And the statute expects, and we expect, that the lockbox is going to be checked in all cases. It's those kinds of global performance requirements. Then these other measurements are kind of subsets to that. How many cases were filed? What was the status of the case, the accounting, and so forth? So I think, I don't know how the rest of you feel about that, but it seems to me we should have a more global approach to what kind of outcome measurements we're talking about. And then some of the detailed compilation of transactions that occur in the various districts of activity. So let's turn to the subject of rules. And I had asked or invited the judges to make a comment regarding the rule effort in their respective districts. We had also gotten an email from Judge Dory and an email from John Michelson about this particular subject. Maybe I could begin with Judge Sturman or Homa with respect to the rule effort in the 8th and sort of where that sits, and then we can talk about the 2nd for a few minutes and then talk about what we might do going forward.
Thank you, Justice Hardison. This is Judge Sturman. Homa and I have sort of agreed to split this. I can talk about history and what we're doing presently. Homa can talk to you about the set of rules that we actually did submit. We do hold benchmark meetings every 2 to 3 months. We combine them, probate and guardianship. We went ahead with our scheduled October 2nd benchmark meeting, and not only because we had Homa and Senator Harris presenting, but it gave us an opportunity to recruit pro bono volunteers. And within a week, we had a volunteer for every family of a decedent. But we had forgotten we live in Las Vegas, and nobody was from there. Out of the entire 58 people, 8 were Nevada residents. But we had a volunteer for every family. Judge Steele had started with a plan and a procedure in place, and her committee was Derek Goldsmith and Homa. And the work product that's in your papers is Derek had it. Derek is our archive. So we appreciate Derek's efforts there. We had tried originally to get some of this passed as local rules through our rules committee and then submitting an ADKT. Due to some problems with correlating the numbers in our new proposal with existing rule numbers, it didn't work out right, so we ended up with a different set of rules currently in place, and the decision was made that we would not work on a new set of local rules until we knew what the statewide rules were going to be. So currently, we are not working on new rules. We are holding that in advance so that we can make sure we correlate properly with the statewide rules, and with that, I'll just let Helma tell you what the efforts they did through Judge Steele's coordination 2 years ago.
Okay.
Thank you, Judge Sturman. Helma Woodrum for the record. So what you have in your materials are kind of the snapshot of what the rules or the discussion looked like when we were advised to press pause on our efforts. Judge Steele was on the prior guardianship commission. She's had us start pretty much immediately with subcommittees trying to come up with local rules because she wanted to get a jump on being ready if it came up. So what we were trying to do was to look chronologically at guardianships, and the goal was to make guardianships accessible for individuals and proper person, kind of with the ideas of access to justice, and then also to open it up potentially to other attorneys who are coming into the area to practice. What should you do? You should check the rules and see what, you know, how the statutes are being interpreted. So obviously some of the things that we were adjusting are inapplicable because it switched from a commissioner system to the current system we have now. But we were trying to include a lot of definitions, things that maybe we assume that people should know and that they don't know. Because if you look at NRS 159, there's terms that are used throughout that maybe aren't in the definition section. And we thought that rules might be a good way to clarify for people. We were able to catch a couple inconsistencies throughout the statutes. Sometimes whether the third degree of consanguinity was significant, and sometimes the second degree of consanguinity is significant. And as we were addressing before, I mean, if a judge has 10 cases they're hearing in a 1 hour period, they're not going to necessarily be checking the certificate of mailing to say, well, does the niece need to be on this one, and does this person need to be on that one? And we were trying to give instructive measures in the same way that our wonderful self-help forms kind of by their existence indicate you need a petition to do this, or you need to make this request to the court. The old way of writing guardianship orders sort of said you are now, you know, empowered with everything NRS 159 says you can do. First of all, that's not the least restrictive. Second of all, it leaves a lot of questions. And so we've got consanguinity, what's an ex parte application, those sorts of things. How one of the biggest points of confusion I've seen from observing court, what does it mean to send something certified mail? What does it mean when it says something will issue? No, the clerk does not issue that document. You draft that document and you get the clerk to put their stamp on it, and people don't realize that. They'll sit there and say, well, it says in the statute the clerk shall issue a citation. Well, no, you draft the citation. I mean, those are things that as practitioners maybe we assume and we don't realize that other people don't know. So we were getting very deep. We figured we could always cut things away. And some of these things have changed as well. I know Judge Ochoa puts an expiration date, for example, on his guardianship letters to try to encourage people to be coming back. I mean, those are potential best practices that should be memorialized potentially in a rule. And so those are some things to consider. We had extensive stuff about temporary guardianships. Again, that landscape has changed considerably since we were working on these, but maybe that guidance would be beneficial to undertake for those cases where I think Judge Walker was talking about the person actually being in danger and what we mean by an emergency versus, oh, their Medicaid days are up. Just as a form of guidance. Sale of real property is a big one. I see even attorneys mess it up as far as when you get permission to even list for sale in the first place. And, you know, and if you read all the statutes together, it doesn't give you a coherent picture of on day one you do this, on day two you do that. And so that's an opportunity for rulemaking. So the group, you know, led by Ms. Goldsmith, we were trying to look at things that we'd seen as problems. And then the big one that's already come up today is this question of vacations, of temporary relocations, permanent relocations. We as a group were trying to decide, well, if you take the long weekend and I'll go to Disneyland, is that something we need to tell the court about versus you're on a cruise? And those are obviously the kind of mental gymnastics lawyers enjoy in their spare time, but I think they're valid questions, because how are we guiding people, you know, when we have them sign their guardian acknowledgement of duties? It says very, very general things, like you're supposed to safeguard this person, or you're supposed to, or looking at the proposed person's or the protected person's Bill of Rights, you're supposed to, you know, presume visitation, all these things. How do we navigate that? So, and then some other basics, captions, e-filing, coding, that's a great place for rules, things that will make it easier for the courts to track. And then we also had some work that we were trying to do as far as fees. But again, a lot of this overlaps with this idea that what outreach are we doing to newly appointed guardians? You know, are there basics that they don't know? That's probably better suited for one of the manuals, like the great one we saw that Ms. McDonald had prepared. But again, we were just trying to attack the rules without any information about where we were going with the legislation. Now that we have the legislation, there's absolutely some things. The questions I get at my office, what does a care plan look like? You know, for professional guardians or for the public guardian, they have the forms they like to use, but judges in the rurals, they tend to vacillate between not wanting so much information because we don't want to put someone's life under scrutiny if we don't have to. Where are their privacy interests? What's going on? I know, you know, do we want to be having these discussions in front of people? So that's kind of where we were with the rules. There's a lot of interest in helping with them and those sort of unspoken procedures we all know to do because we practice guardianship, but we want to make sure that other people know that those are the best practices. Those are the things that we're all doing anyway, and we need to make sure that other people are buying into it.
Again, this is Jed Sherman's. These were incredibly complex and step-by-step, some of which might be better in a procedural manual than in a rule. So that's what we're just waiting to see. How to use this because it's valuable work product.
So, thanks, Judge and Homa, for your input. I'd like to hear from other committee members about what they think the rules, statewide rules, should generally look like. It seems to me that rules shouldn't be a procedure manual. I think I'm not criticizing the effort that was made. I applaud it, in fact, and Judge Steele and I conferred a number of times about the effort that was being made by the committee and by the bench bar, and I thought it was terrific. But what I felt was, especially after reviewing much of this material over the weekend, I was reminded about the fact that this seemed to me to be, not all of it, some of it, procedural in nature and training in nature, and quite frankly, Ms. McDonald's manual answers a number of the questions that are raised here. So I wanted to separate the rule-making function from the procedure function and the training function, because I think they should be separated. I also don't think that rules should be enacted that contradict the statute. But I do think rules can be enacted that help interpret the statute. And we've had two pretty good examples of that today. One involving the frequency and the time when notices regarding moving needs to be filed. I think that can be addressed by rule. And these are Supreme Court rules, so they're statewide in effect. The other one that I think is also capable of being interpreted is the service rules. Once you have counsel, we generally don't require personal service of the parties going forward. That seems silly. And so it would seem like the rules could accommodate for that. That's how I would envision the rules proceeding forward, is interpreting gray areas that may exist within the statute, as long as the rule isn't in conflict. And then at the same time, picking up some open area that is a best practice that should be covered as part of the court's procedure. Now, I defer to Judge Sturman and Judge Ochoa because I know that in the 8th, things get kind of detailed in those rules, like the time or the hours of the court. Is that really something that is necessary in the rule? I'm just asking a question. I'm not asking a rhetorical question. It's really a legitimate question. There's some detail in there that looks like it deals with court operation, and I would imagine that that's something that the chief judge and even you folks would want to have more flexibility about, but I don't know. I mean, I'm just asking the question.
Yeah, correct. This is again Judge Sherman for the record. I'll defer to Judge Ochoa as well, but I think that since our rules are pretty much, they're pretty old, they're pretty filing, they've adapted some of them, but not all of them. So yes, there is information in there that is no longer really relevant. We don't have drop boxes anymore for people to come after hours, for example, it's in these rules. We don't have them anymore. It's all e-box. So some of this is just generally out of date, and you're right, largely procedural and technically no longer relevant.
I think the rules are, we're just a work in progress. We're going to have to make a lot of changes, and there'll be a whole new set of rules. The rules that were written do not apply now.
So here's what I'd
for
like.
The most part.
Here's what I'd like to ask other committee or commission members, conceptually. What should be in the rules, the statewide rules? Now, we refer to them as statewide rules, but frankly, in the legal profession, we're so used to having districts having their own rules, that's where we get into trouble. The effort of statewide rules is to eliminate the use of district-specific rules that create all this confusion. So when I say statewide rules, I'm talking about the set of rules that's going to be used in every district to marshal and administer these guardianship proceedings. I'm inviting comment from commission members about what do you think conceptually the rules should consist of?
Justice Rice, this is Judge Sherman again. Because only Washoe and Clark County are set up with judges who hear family matters, or because minor guardianship is still exclusively family, it makes more sense for them to be able to adapt local procedures to those two areas. And otherwise, everybody in the state should be following the rules that come out of this commission, because they should apply statewide equally everywhere. It's just one statute. The only things we need to put in our local rules are those things that are unique to how local courts run. And I can really only think Washoe County and Clark County are the ones who have that issue.
I'm just thinking that, you know, we're probably going to need more detail in Clark County, but is that going to be fair to the people in Elko to have to follow the same rules we have when they have fewer cases? I don't know. And if we make a general rule for the whole state, is it going to be helpful in Washoe County and Clark County?
Well, let me ask, I would think that issues regarding service, for example, like we just talked about, should be a statewide rule. You shouldn't have different service rules in Elko versus service rules in Clark or not. I would imagine that a rule that clarifies this business about residency move or location move would be a rule that would be useful to the entire state. That's the kind of approach I think that these rules need to take. I also think that to the extent that court operations are being governed by rules in the eighth and the second, it's my view that that's what the chief judge is all about. So they enter administrative orders to affect those court operations rather than having rules dealing with that subject. It's much more effective, much more efficient, and it's easy to maneuver for the district and the chief judge who's involved in that process. But I think at least the two examples I gave, maybe there are other examples that are contrary to what I've suggested, but it seems to me that those are the kinds of examples that would be a statewide rule that rural counties would live with and be happy about, as would urban counties. How about practitioners or Ms. Kelly, what about your thoughts? Are you concerned about the what should be in the rules, and if so, what should be there, especially as it relates to the functions and responsibilities of the public guardian?
I guess from our perspective, it's having something that's very clear that we understand if we go into any courtroom, and whichever judge it is, that we're going to have the same the same thing is going to be asked of us in each courtroom. I think rules for us is that would be the best outcome of any rules, is that we have a very fluid between different courtrooms of who's hearing the cases. Whether that's local or state, I don't,
I'm not sure how that would work. But just within our, with where we are, having the same rules apply across and everybody understands what's going to be requested of them.
Well, I think it's critical to consistency, for sure.
Homo Woodrum, for the record, I had a meeting with the Douglas County Public Guardian last week, and they have this really unique circumstance where they have protected persons in other counties that they're responsible for because the services they need to get are in other counties. So they start, for example, as a resident of Minden or Gardnerville, and they will continue to have their guardianship even if they're getting services somewhere else. And they were telling me that the inconsistency is very difficult because the care plans or budgets or things that one court expects don't look like the other court. But they were also saying that the clarification on service is important too, because they have no funding to do service, they have no funding to do publication of notices and those sorts of things. So that's another consideration that I hadn't thought of, is that the county gave them a set amount of funds and they may not be able to even use the local sheriff because they want $60 to go personally serve someone in a care facility. So I just thought I might offer that as an additional public guardian perspective that's different than maybe Washoe or Clark, because they're more likely in the rurals to have individuals across counties.
Well, and the case plan is another great example where the rule can articulate at least the minimum requirements for a case plan.
Yeah.
And the whole state then knows what to look at. I'm sure the judges would appreciate that. Yes, Judge Dory?
Clearly, if we're going to use statewide forms, that should be in state rules.
Yeah.
Mandatory use of the forms. And perhaps those forms will be added to over time. Our rules are so dated that not too many of them withstand the test of time. We do have a rule that suggests or requires final accounting to be done in temporary guardianships. Sometimes the case doesn't go beyond the temporary guardianship. And so you give authority to a guardian, they use funds, and then they don't end up filing final accounting. If that isn't anywhere in the statute, which I'm guessing it's not that specific, we might want that as a rules because that's really important. Another thing might be the protocol for appointment of counsel for the protected person. What we found happening in Washoe County is they would come to the first hearing, so that was after the 20-day notice, and then they would have to grant another extension for appointment. So we moved the appointment up to the filing of the petition, and with the declination, pronounced at the date of the hearing. So when a petition is filed, the attorney is appointed. Then at the hearing, the attorney either states reasons to decline or the client says, I don't want that person. But otherwise, we can move forward that day, and that saves about 20 days in processing the guardianship. So, you know, maybe practices like that could be incorporated in the state rule.
Okay. Hank?
I think in, Hank Cavallera, I think in New Jersey, I think I submitted this to the temporary commission, but I think in New Jersey they have a requirement that the court-appointed counsel file a report sometime before the first hearing. And I think that's something that we might want to look at, because if I'm the attorney representing the guardian, I have no idea what to expect. It's going to, you know, that the protected person's counsel's going to want to do. So I think that's something we want to look at in terms of What are the reports, the filings that the counsel is going to have to make just to keep the case on track? I don't know if you see that creating a barrier, persons coming in.
It's not, because we have three attorneys now through Washoe Legal Services, and the bar is small enough that the relationship is very good and very effective in communicating. I can see where in a larger district that could be a challenge. The attorneys could file a notice of acceptance of counsel before the beginning of the before the hearing. It's going fairly smoothly right now.
Jim, what's your experience in Clark County? Is it necessary to file a notice of appearance?
So right now, the appointment of counsel is working slightly differently. I have checked with Washoe and investigated how they appoint counsel up there. Right now, we are not being appointed at the initial petition, because we don't have enough counsel, we don't have enough attorneys to cover all the cases. So what's happening is the judges are triaging the cases and appointing us, referring the cases to us, and issuing orders appointing counsel, which we can then use to get the confidential documents and go and visit the protected person. So typically we have visited the proposed protected person before the initial hearing. So that's how it's working right now.
You have the lawyers coming on board?
We just hired one, and we're actively recruiting. So if anybody knows of anybody who's looking for a job, please send them our way.
I have a concern. How many cases are being heard in the 8th where counsel isn't appointed?
This is Judge Ochoa. I would say right now, since legal services is not taking any cases, I have every week of at least 15 new cases where I need to assign attorneys. And I'm also concerned about telling the individuals involved who's going to pay for this attorney, because I don't know the answer to that question yet. So we have a, right now, maybe until the end of the year, we have a need for attorneys, and I don't know when legal services is going to be back online.
Okay, so I think we need a meeting about this straight away, because that's not the vision. And it's certainly not.
I'm sorry again, this is Judge Sherman. Could you move the microphone a little closer?
I think we need a meeting right away, because I don't think that's the vision. There is a, I'm not criticizing, please don't treat this as criticism at all. I get the point that legal services may not have adequate lawyers, but that funding stream has kicked into effect, and it contemplated paying for those folks. So if they don't have the lawyers, then that money is accumulating, and it should be, as it is in the rurals, available to the judges to use to compensate lawyers that they have to appoint that would be outside of the legal aid program. So I think we need to talk about that.
Thank you, Justice Hardy. This is Judge Sherman. I think we welcome that. Tim Andrews, our assistant court manager over this, probably has a little bit better idea of how the county views that money. And we should perhaps have a meeting with Legal Aid Services, the county, and court admin. It'd be very helpful.
This is Judge Ochoa. I know the county has a program for abuse and neglect. They have contract attorneys. They provide a list of who's on the contract, and we just go down the list. But there's no such list, and we don't even have a letter that they're going to pay. So I'm kind of afraid to appoint people and without something in a written form saying they're going to be compensated and at what rate, or whether they're going to be, they can charge their own rate, or whether it's going to be a contract rate.
Got it. I'll be down there, and we can have.
Thank you.
We'll get a meeting together on this, because that's not what the vision is. So if there's a slip between a couple of those, we'll fix it. Okay?
Thank you.
I'm glad this service. I appreciate you telling me about it. Okay.
Justice?
So here's, yes, I'm sorry, Mike, go ahead.
To answer your question about what other things, I've seen lots of misunderstanding on the roles of guardian ad litems versus attorneys for the protected person. And I think the local rules or statewide rules could give some direction on that.
And we have been specifically tasked by the Supreme Court to address that. So I completely agree.
Another,
now,
pardon, one of the second district's rules that has not become obsolete by time, I think, is a requirement that you put the amount of fees that you're requiring in the notice of hearing on the petition for fees. It's a small thing, but if we really want people to be aware of what's happening and to get the notice out, what good is a notice of a petition and fees? If you've got the number there, that gives about as good notice as you could to anyone.
Sure.
Good one.
Homa
Woodrum for the record. That was a big one we noticed in the rules committee. Was we, those of us who are employing best practices, were sending out, for example, citations with the petition, or we were sending out notice of hearing with the actual document that we were asking to be heard. And when you go back and look at it,
it appears that you don't have to do that. And the question is whether that's appropriate for the rules to say either put the number or put the real, you know, meat of the question in the notice or require inclusion of the document.
I think that's another good example of covering that by rule and imposing that requirement. Any other suggestions or input with respect to the rules conceptually?
One more from the second district, requirement that the petition be verified. I don't know what 8U district does.
It should be verified. That's out, I mean, it should be verified or attested. I mean, now we're broader in our definition of that under state law and local rules.
Right.
So that's a whole, that's one of the things that has to be amended.
Yeah. Sabrina, you had a comment?
Yes, thank you. To add on what Mr. Keene was saying, not only to determine rules for appointment of attorney in GAL, but specifically in the minor guardianship cases to appoint investigators. Judge Walker, our court administrator, myself, met with the public guardian's office as well as Ms. Reed and found that between all of the different statutes, there are a lot of loopholes which make appointing an investigator in a minor guardianship case very difficult, so it would be very helpful to have that defined in a statewide rule.
Okay. Has that been addressed, Judge Sturman, do you know, by your colleagues in the family court? I think they still decided to pursue the splitting up of the minor guardianships among all of the judges there, is that right?
Correct.
Have they discussed?
Yes, they have rebalanced the minor guardianships among all. There's 14 of the departments that your minor guardianships in.
Right. There's 16 judges hearing the minor guardianships. I think the agreement is that it's not a good plan, and the presiding judge, the new presiding judge, Judge Duckworth, the rumors are he may relook at that. I also agree that it should be concentrated in fewer hands and maybe an appointment of a new, one more judge in abuse and neglect, and then those judges would hear the minor guardianships. I'm still trying to get the numbers on the number of guardianships, minor guardianships that come from abuse and neglect cases, and I think it will show that a substantial number will come from abuse and neglect cases. And those judges know the parties, they know the issues, they've heard the trial already, so it would be kind of a misuse of time to have everyone appear again and have a second trial and with all the same parties in front of a new judge.
Well, I shudder to think the appeals that would generate. And I'm not quite sure how our court would deal with that you've got conflicting outcomes. That doesn't make sense. That really is something that should be revisited for sure, as you suggested. Here's what I'd like to do to try to make progress on this, and I'm open to what other people feel, obviously. But I'd like to appoint co-chairs, to a rules subcommittee whose responsibility it would be to take a look at these various drafts, take into account some of the comments that have been made here, and work to formulate a draft that we can work from. I have asked Ms. Reed to co-chair the subcommittee from the north. I'd like to ask Mr. Michelson if he would consider co-chairing the subcommittee from the south, and then I would like to, would you accept that appointment, Mr. Michelson?
I would be honored to do that.
All right, and then I'd like to ask that if possible, if they're willing to, I'd like to request that Ms. Woodrum serve on the committee because of her background and her connection with this particular program. I'd also like to request that Lynn Hughes and Michael Keene serve on the committee if they would be willing to accept. accept that assignment or appointment?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that acceptable? Lynn?
Yes, that's, I will do that.
Okay. Now, I am, will leave to, and in fact, we invite, but leave to Ms. Reed and Mr. Michelson the authority to appoint no more than two more people to the committee. I don't think you need more folks. That can oftentimes be a bad thing. But if you feel like you need a couple more folks on the committee, then I would invite you to go ahead and do that. Just let me know who you've appointed so that I can confirm that. My objective here is to try to get a working draft, recognizing that it'll get picked over by the commission, by the next meeting of the commission in January. So that would provide, probably be about the middle of January, somewhere in that time frame. It may be an ambitious schedule, given the nature of the subject, but I'm thinking that we're going to have another meeting of the commission, not as long as this one, but to focus on outcome measurements and to talk about forms. And then the next meeting would be to take up the rules. And this would enable the commission to provide a tentative report to the Supreme Court as required in our order by the end of January. And then obviously, as we've all recognized, much of this is a work in progress, so the commission will continue to refine this. But I think it's critical for the practitioners, for the judges and the like, to get some of this in place. Now, it's a little bit daunting, but at the same time, we're really far down the road. Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada has done a tremendous job with the forms. I think if Stephanie McDonald can work with us on the form issues, we can go a long ways in having a good set of forms that can be tendered to the court by the end of January. Mr. Burkhold, I'd like to request if you would accept the responsibility of chairing that form subcommittee and working with Stephanie to try to reconcile, not try to, but to reconcile the forms being used in the second and the ones being used in the eighth and those that were suggested in the manual.
I'd be happy to do that.
And then I would request, if it's acceptable, for Sabrina to work on that committee and assist Jim. If there are other people who'd like to serve on the forms committee, I'd welcome that. Would anybody like to assist those folks on the forms committee?
Can we volunteer someone who's not on the committee?
Of course.
So our self-help attorney would be an excellent person to include.
Perfect.
Emily Reed?
Would that be Emily Reed? Perfect. So Jim, did you catch that name?
Emily Reed?
Yeah, she is the self-help lawyer in the second district.
Great.
Okay. Anybody else would like to serve on that forms committee? Yes, Alder.
Your Honor. Would it be beneficial if, so since I would be helping with the Rules Committee, then we would have some like communication in that way if I also helped with the Forms Committee? Is that, are you amenable to that, or is
of
that?
Of course, sure.
Okay,
sure,
so I would be happy to volunteer if that's
helpful. Yeah, sure, of course, that's fine. That'd be great. And Mike?
I volunteer my time. I have a question.
Yeah.
Excuse me, just about the forms. California has mandatory forms. Are we thinking that some of these forms would be mandatory,
yep,
like the petition?
Yep. And that would be covered in the rules, by the way. The rules would spell out that certain forms would be mandatory. Now, obviously, at the end of the day, I'm really going to count on Judge Doherty, Judge Walker, Judge Ochoa, and Judge Sherman to look at these forms and make sure that the judges are satisfied with the form that they're going to be confronted with. They need to feel comfortable that it's complete and so forth. So at the end of the day, in addition to the rules and the forms, the judges are going to have to really look through these very carefully and make sure that they're comfortable with that. So Vince, Lori, you'll have to alert other colleagues that are going to be working on this, that when these drafts come out, I really need your input back on these things relatively quickly, and other judges who might be involved in it will need to get back to us also.
And just to try to see Judge Sherman again, I agree. One concern I have is because we are handling minor and adult guardianships differently, is there perhaps something they should look at is whether forms need to be different for minor versus adult guardianships, or rules need to be different for minors versus adult guardianships. Maybe that's just a problem for Las Vegas, but it may apply elsewhere.
Well, I think it's a good point, and I would just ask Mr. Michelson, Ms. Reed, to be cognizant that maybe as the statute was separated between adult and minor, it may be necessary to separate the rules for adult and minor, for sure. So, but I don't want to prejudge that, but it's a good point, something we need to think about. Sure. As to the forms, I think some forms would be common, but obviously there are forms that are different, some forms that are different. And so, of course, there should be a set of minor guardianship forms to the extent that the statute calls for a different way to handle that process. So, for example, forms appointing investigators might be something that would be in the minor guardianship arena that wouldn't be in the adult guardianship arena. I don't know. So that's kind of an outline of how I'd like to proceed. How does the committee feel about that? Is that acceptable to everybody? Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
All right. So I really appreciate the willingness of you folks to take on these responsibilities. Sharon is here to assist with some staff and scheduling coordination for you, so I want you to work with Sharon on that. That's the expectation, and that she's going to help coordinate meetings with the subcommittees as necessary. And with the exception of the forum, Stephanie McDonald agreed to take on that task, and Jim, you'll assist us in coordinating with her on that.
Yes.
Okay. The other thing I would like to do is I'd like to get either Judge Young from the 9th Judicial District or his designee on both the rules and the forms subcommittee. I think the 9th has done a tremendous job in this area and can offer a lot of rural insight to us. And I'm also going to ask Judge Porter from Elko to join both the rules and the forms subcommittee, or her designee, because she was a tremendous asset in all of the commission work before, and she is particularly familiar with the minor guardianship area because she and Egan wrote it, so they know that statute pretty well. So I'll reach out to both judges and ask them to participate on those committees.
A question, Homo Woodrum, for the record. I've been getting a lot of inquiries about whether the forms are ever going to be available in things like Braille. Where should we be directing people who are asking for those accessibility measures?
Well, I think both from an interpreter standpoint, different languages is an issue. Braille is another. Let me back up to the interpreter issues. Jim, if I'm wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Stephanie is partway through at least doing Spanish language conversion of some of the forms. Is that right?
I don't know the answer to that.
This is Judge Sherman, the Judge Chow. Yes, we've got several forms translated. I don't know all of them.
Well, I know the. Some of the forms are already translated. We have seen them already.
So
those usually are the ones, the initial petition.
The guardian's acknowledgement of duty. We've got that one in Spanish.
So we need to
report guardian.
We'll need to coordinate that, Homa, but not but. And we have worked with the university in the past to provide some of the Braille translation. But here's the cool place that it can be done very quickly and without much cost, and that's the Nevada Department of Corrections. They have a whole set of guys and gals, and they're mostly guys, who are doing Braille translation. And so as soon as we get these forms in place, I'll get a hold of Jim Dresna, the director of the Nevada Department of Corrections, and I think we can get some Braille translations moving. It's really quite an operation down there in the Southern Nevada Correction Facility and at High Desert, both. So we have an answer for that. We just need to get the forms and the rules in place, and then we can look at those kinds of solutions or those kinds of issues. Okay. All right. Anything further? We have a brief presentation on the Supreme Court mediation program. Okay. Sounds good. And then we can close up shop for the day and move on about our business. I want to tell those of you who are chairing these subcommittees, keep me advised of your dates. I'm going to try to attend as many of your meetings as I can. It may be necessary to do so by phone, but I will make a sincere effort to be at all of them if I can. And if you need any help with resources or folks or people or whatever, I will try to help pull that together. I didn't purposefully want the judges, other than the two that I've mentioned, to serve on these committees, because these judges have got enough to do just dealing with their dockets. So, and their time is going to come, because we're going to hand them a phone book and we're going to tell them, proofread the phone book, Judge Sturban, and tell us what's wrong. And you have about a nanosecond to answer. So their day is coming.
Is each form finished by the committee?
You bet. Yeah, I think that's a good point. We're not just going to dump a truckload of stuff on there. As we get that stuff done, we want to get it to you so you can review it. Okay, let's see. Sharon, are they on their way?
They're on their way, and okay. They have to connect to the...
While we're waiting for those presenters to come in, I would like to hold a meeting roughly 30 days hence for a couple of hours to talk with more, basically to harass Riley and Mallory and Sabine.
What else?
No, to hear their report and to try to work toward finalizing our outcome measurements, at least the initial set that we're going to recommend. So Sharon will be putting out a doodle poll, or whatever they call that thing, to solicit dates, but roughly 30 days hence. So around the 10th, 11th, 12th or so of December. Yes,
the 11th and 12th is judicial selection for the second.
Okay. So we'll have to avoid those 2 days for sure. But in any event, sometime around the middle of December, a couple hour meeting for the committee to take a look at the outcome measurement information or work that's been developed there. And then we'll have another meeting and to tentatively look at whatever forms have been generated, and then we can pass those on to the judges, whatever it didn't develop so far. And then in January, roughly the middle of January, 15-ish, 16-ish, to take a look at a draft set of statewide rules. Okay? All righty. Hi there.
Hello.
Hi. Okay, good.
friendly. I'm just bringing the earth.
I know, just listen.
They're made for children.
I know.
This is how much I can imagine drinking at one time. I'm like, I can do this. January 15th is Martin Luther King holiday. Just if he's taking my round numbers, yeah.
Oh, yeah, the risk is horseshoes, not
extras.
There you go.
Most people are going to have them. So if they have extraordinary assets, then that can be the trigger to say, okay.
I always know that in January, I'd look at, is that the 15th? Is that the 22nd?
Yeah.
Let me introduce you all to the extent that they need an introduction to Harriet Cummings, who is the assistant clerk of court, and also Shauna Troop, who manages the mediation program, the mandatory settlement program, I should say, for the Supreme Court. And so the purpose of this presentation is to give you a sense of how the Supreme Court's mandatory mediation program operates and to consider its application or a structure like this to guardianship proceedings. So, Ms. Cummings, Ms. Troop, thank you.
Thank you, Justice Hardesty. So, we will just give you a brief overview of the Supreme Court settlement program. I'll tell you a little bit about the history of the program, give you some statistics. Shauna will talk to you about how cases are assigned to the program. We'll talk about how the mechanics of the program work, timelines of the program, and then we will give you some specific information regarding guardianship cases. Just a little historical background why the court even has a civil settlement program. For those of you who've been around a long time, you might recall that back in the 1990s, the Supreme Court had a huge backlog of cases. It was the busiest Supreme Court in the country, and so necessity being the mother of invention, the court was looking for ways to innovate to address the backlog of cases, and so the court instituted the civil settlement program. The court expanded from 5 justices to 7 so that it could sit in 2 3-judge panels, and also the court instituted the criminal fast track program. And so those were all measures that the court took to address that backlog. And we instituted the civil settlement program. Our settlement judges are not judges in the true sense of the word. They, in fact, act as mediators. So it is an appellate mediation program. And at the time the program was instituted, it was determined determined that up to a 25% success rate would warrant continuing the program. I'm pleased to report that 20 years later, we're still going, and the program has been used as a model for similar programs elsewhere. And although it has been tweaked a bit over the years, its basic function is to allow the parties to resolve their differences without further burdening the courts. And so here you see on the screen some statistics from program inception, March 1, 1997. 10,899 cases have been assigned to the program, and of those, total number of cases that have settled, 5,082, and that's information as of last week. I mentioned that a success rate of over 25% would warrant justify having the program continue. Since inception, our lowest settlement rate has been 40%, highest settlement rate has been 60%, and the average over the years has been a 52% settlement rate, so over twice what had originally been deemed sufficient to justify the program continuing. Here's a breakdown by case type of settlement rates, and as you can see, depending on the type of case, settlement rates sometimes drop into the 20s, sometimes in the 60s, but I am pleased to report that at the appellate mediation level, the guardianship cases that have been assigned to the program, the settlement rate has been 69%, so that's our highest rate of settlement at the appellate level. Just a caveat attached to that is that we have not seen a lot of guardianship cases come through the settlement program over the years, but they do lend themselves to a high settlement rate. The next screen that you see is the average amount of time pending in the settlement program. As you can see, from inception, 1997, cases on average spent 288 days in the program, and on your screen there, but in the materials that were handed out, you'll see that in 2016, the average number of days was 90, and this year we are averaging a mere 70 days in the program. So some of the innovations that have been brought to the program over the years are efficiencies that have taken us from 288 days down to a mere 70 days in the program. So I'll turn it over to Sean.
What cases are assigned to the settlement program? All civil appeals where the parties are represented by counsel. However, no termination of parental rights are in the program, no writ proceedings, no pro se proceedings, and no criminal cases are in the program. The parties learn that a case has been assigned to the program when the court issues a settlement notice of assignment, and that assignment will automatically stay transcripts and briefings. How do cases get assigned to a settlement judge? The settlement judges will inform me when they're available to take cases. Some take many cases, some take a 4-year. It just depends on if they're in a law firm or what their calendar looks like. They are assigned on a rotational basis. Any related cases that may come in that are already assigned to a settlement judge, they'll get that second or third case also. They will do a conflicts check. And then the court will issue a notice of assignment. How the process works. The pre-mediation requirements. The settlement judge will hold a pre-mediation telephone conference to assess whether it is appropriate for settlement or possibly if it's not appropriate after gathering information. And the settlement judge will also inform the parties of expectations. And then after that, we'll file an early case assessment report within 30 days, informing the court whether it is appropriate or not. If it is not, the briefing timelines do get reinstated. However, if the settlement judge does take a case, parties will submit a confidential settlement statement within 15 days of assignment, which is not served on the court or the opposing side. The settlement judge will then schedule a settlement conference. child custody, visitation, relocation, guardianship is within 60 days of assignment. All other cases are within 90 days. Then the settlement judge will designate the time and the place of the mediation.
So once the settlement judge schedules the mediation, all parties and all attorneys are required to attend in person. Client attendance may be excused by the settlement judge only for good cause shown, and only if counsel has complete authority to settle the case and or immediate telephone access to the client. I believe our settlement judges would tell you that if they don't have the parties face-to-face in the room, that does diminish the likelihood of settlement in a particular case. All participants are required to sign a mandatory attendance sheet and confidentiality acknowledgement form. The proceedings are confidential as to all people in the room at the time the settlement conference takes place. The settlement judge sets the agenda for the settlement conference, and the model of mediation that we teach to our settlement judges and that the court prefers they use in the program is the facilitative model of mediation. If you're familiar with the different models, there's the transformative model, the evaluative model, but we prefer the facilitative model for mediation. And so the settlement judge serves more in the role of a process manager or facilitator, so that it is a party-driven process.
Post-mediation requirements. The settlement judge will submit the mandatory attendance sheet and confidentiality form to the court. It cannot be filed because, again, it's confidential. From that, we will send out surveys to not only counsel but also to the parties. And that gives us some information of how the program's doing and how our settlement judges are doing. We are constantly striving to improve the program, so it's really helpful when those evaluations come back to the court. After the mediation, the settlement judge will file a status report within 10 days of the conference. It includes results but not details. It cannot disclose matters discussed, and it will also include any information for related cases. If the process needs to be continued, a settlement judge will file an interim report scheduling it for another conference and the time and the date where that will be where that will take place.
So if following the settlement conference the case does in fact settle, the parties will execute their settlement agreement. However, that agreement is not required to be filed with the court. What is required to be filed with the court is the settlement judge files a final settlement report within 10 days of the settlement conference. The parties then will either execute a stipulation to dismiss the appeal, which does get filed with the court, or appellant might file a motion voluntarily dismissing the appeal, but the court will not act on just the report filed by the settlement judge alone. It requires affirmative action by the parties to dismiss the case once it has settled. As far as what parts of the process are confidential, everything about the process is confidential except for the settlement conference status reports that do get filed by the settlement judge. And those either say that the case has settled, that the case has not settled, or that an additional mediation has been scheduled. Basically all that those reports say. So any documents exchanged between the settlement judge and the parties, or amongst the parties as part of the settlement process, are not for public consumption, and they do not get filed with the court. Those settlement discussions and those documents that might be exchanged are not admissible in evidence, nor are they discoverable. And just as attorneys have duties of confidentiality to their clients, judges have duties of confidentiality under the Code of Judicial Conduct. Our settlement judges have their own code of conduct that includes confidentiality provisions.
How long can a case be assigned custody, visitation, relocation, or guardianship cases, it is 120 days. For all other cases, it's 180 days. The mediator can recommend an extension up to 60 days for the child custody guardianship cases or 90 days for other cases. Timelines, however, can be reinstated if the case lingers in the on the docket for too long. And here you have a graph of settlement program timelines from case assignment to case completion. So again, the party's confidential settlement statements are 15 days from assignment, the early case assessment report 30 days from assignment, a settlement conference must be held within 60 days for the guardianship and child custody, 90 days for all other cases, and then finally the final report will be due 120 days in guardianship, child custody, and 180 days for all other cases. If the case does not settle, briefing and transcript deadlines are reinstated. The appellant will have a transcript request due within 10 days. Fully briefed non-child custody cases, 120 days for an opening brief, followed with an answering brief for 30 days, and then the reply brief will be due 30 days after that. For fast-track child custody cases, a fast-track statement is required within 40 days, the response 20 days, and the court may also order full briefing for these matters. For the fully briefed cases in child custody and visitation, the opening brief is due 90 days, answering brief due 20 days, and then followed by a reply brief in 10 days. So in summary, for the guardianship matters, the settlement program deadlines are the confidential settlement statement within 15 days, the early case assessment report is 30 days. A settlement conference must be held within 60 days. The final report is due within 120 days. And then if there is no settlement, a briefing deadline reinstated is the appellant's transcript request form is 10 days. The appellant's fast track statement and appendix 40 days, followed by the response in 20 days.
So just to conclude, the historical rate of settlement in guardianship matters, 69%, so they have a higher chance of being settled historically than other types of cases on the court's docket. In addition to the high success rate, there are numerous other advantages to this settlement program that apply to guardianship cases as well as other types of cases. The parties can have a speedier resolution of the case at a lower cost, because if they are able to reach settlement, then there's no need for briefing, potentially oral argument, and any other matters that may be part of the appellate process. In addition, it's because it is a party-powered process, it gives the parties a creative opportunity to resolve their differences, typically results in a higher level of satisfaction and a mutually beneficial outcome, and they avoid the risks that may adhere to having the case go through the appellate process, because of course they don't have any control over the outcome. It's up to the justices to decide the case. And we rely heavily on our settlement judges for the program's success, and so we have specific requirements for people to become settlement judges for the Supreme Court's program. So that concludes our presentation. Do you have any questions? Yes?
Justice Hardesty?
Yeah.
May I ask, are these slides also going to be made available for us?
Yes, indeed.
Thank you.
They'll be shipped out tomorrow or as soon as Sharon can get them out to all of you. Yeah.
Homo Woodrum, for the record, the data you have on guardianship cases that have wound their way up to the settlement program, do you guys split those out as far as adult and minor, or are they just treated as one classification?
I believe they're just treated as one classification.
Okay. How do you assess the fees?
I'm sorry?
The cost?
The cost? Settlement judges can be paid up to $100 per hour for a maximum of 10 hours.
By the parties?
No.
By the court?
The court pays that.
The court has this money in its budget, It is a line item that the legislature appropriates. And so part of the reason I wanted to make this presentation is because I would like to explore, depending on how the committee feels, I'd like to explore some tweaking to this program, which is, I think you would acknowledge, has been pretty successful, and see if it's a way to incorporate the structure statewide for guardianship cases at the district court level. We would, of course, need, I think mediators in the guardianship area need to be specially trained, or at least have some additional training beyond what they currently have. But I do think that it's a structure that would work well. The problem is that if you're going to have required mediation in contested cases, you need to have a structure in place that can accommodate it. Otherwise, it's a meaningless requirement in rural counties for sure. And I'm not exactly sure, Judge Sturman, Judge Ochoa, who you resort to for court-ordered mediations. I don't know, frankly, what Judge Doherty does, but it would seem to me that the whole state would benefit from a statewide system that's equipped to be able to handle those cases and mitigate the impact on district courts. It especially makes sense, by the way, when you have a statewide compliance office. It is a service that I think could be really beneficial to the whole state. Judge?
So we had a two-day training for our mediators by Margaret Crowley and another professional mediator. We then created a list of trained mediators, and they also had to walk through the 40-hour mediation before that through the university. When mediation is ordered, counsel and the parties pick from the list of mediators, or if it's a low-income case, they go to the neighborhood mediation center, which has accepted them without cost. They mediate in private mediation. The outcomes are reported if it's settled, or the court is just informed if it's not settled. They mediate the fee. The parties are informed as well as the other family members. This isn't free. And so, and the state will not necessarily bear the entire obligation, so that's a component of the mediation. But they're advised that they may be responsible for the cost because it's not settled.
Justice Tarski, Gloria Sturman, we rely on the senior judges.
The senior judges, okay.
Yes, they're very effective.
Yeah,
and Chief Judge Ochoa.
Go ahead, Jim.
Sorry. On minor guardianships, I'm using the family mediation system. If there's a guardianship, minor guardianship problems between family members. On the adult guardianships, I think mediation will work because sometimes the families are just fighting about whether they're going to have permission to see mom. And if they get those answers to their questions, then there really isn't a litigation to go forward with.
So what I'd like to do is have a conference call with the judges involved in the guardianship process to see how we can deal with this. Again, I want to get Judge Porter and Judge Young involved in such a call and see what we can do to build a structure that would be accommodating to the rural counties as well. But I think that senior judges are a resource, frankly, for the rurals, and they're already paid. And so I think that these are some options that we have available to us. I think what's critical for the successful operation of these mediation programs, and especially this one, at the Supreme Court level, is when we shorten the time frames. People used to use these mandatory settlement program as a way of just putting off the inevitable. I think it's vitally important that there, and I would think this would be true at the guardianship level too, that these mediation events are fairly strict in their timelines so that people aren't using these to just put off decision making or inflict harm on someone. Do you have timelines, Judge Sturman, Judge Ochoa, in the mediations you assign, or are you tracking those timelines? Are you able to?
This is Judge Sherman. Right now, it's just based on when they're scheduled for their evidentiary hearing. They're told they have to be finished with it by the time of our status check, and pretty much leave it to Eileen for when she can get them somebody who can handle that type of a negotiation.
This is Judge Ochoa. I ask them how much time they need for discovery, and then tell them as soon as they're ready, we'll have a senior judge available if we're going to go senior judge route.
Okay. So there is some timeline imposed in both those circumstances.
Yeah, usually 60 to 90 days.
We usually have a 30-day trial turnaround time to the trial, so the mediation occurs within that time frame. I have to say, sometimes it goes off track.
Sure.
Because they stipulate to continue and to continue.
Yeah, because they're still working on the 90-day. Yes, Hank?
Hank Cavalera. Judge Doherty, I just wanted to ask, in the mediations, are there situations where, by way of example, the parties might mediate to have a supportive decision-making agreement to do task 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then the guardianship court takes control of the remaining issues?
That would be a perfectly legitimate outcome for mediation. I don't know if we're that far.
No, I'm just wondering if you've had that or if you've envisioned that.
But I do have attorneys now referencing SCO.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Harriet. We really appreciate your input today. Is there any public comment? Judge Sturman, anybody in Las Vegas who'd like to make a public comment?
No, nobody's present.
Did Riley?
I think Michael wants to talk.
I'm terribly disappointed. I thought Riley for sure would want to make a public comment.
He needs a call.
I don't see anyone here in Carson City who wishes to make a public comment. So with that, we'll entertain an adjournment, and I'll alert all of you that Ms. Coates will be sending out an email tomorrow that will set the next two dates, one in roughly middle December and one in roughly middle January, and ask you to respond, if you would, within 24 hours of the dates that she offers for both. Again, I want to thank everybody for your work today and your commitment to serve on the subcommittees. I think it's going to be vital to be able to move this forward to get this completed. Thanks everybody for your time and effort.
Wait,
can I
interject?
Oh, Sherry?
I just want to make sure that everybody signed the attendance sheets. I had one for Las Vegas and here. And did Senator Harris ever make it? Can they not hear me? Or?
Gloria, did Senator Harris make it to the meeting?
Senator Harris did not make it, no sir.
Okay, and you got the assignment sheets, attendance sheets.
Right here.
Okay, thanks everybody.
Thank you. That was 168 tweets. See if we can beat that next time.